made it to episode 3 of Behind the Science of Career Development, the podcast for the Asia Pacific Career Development Journal. My name is Dr. Brian Hutchison. I'm the editor of the journal and also get to be the host of this podcast. Please look us up on the podcast platform that you use, such as Spotify or Apple, or I think about half a dozen others. Thus far, we have had over 220 downloads and listens of our first two episodes. And I'm really excited today. We're going to switch it up slightly. The first two episodes have been from authors about the process of writing their article for the journal. Today, we do have someone who's been a second author on an article, but really today we have a guest who is an associate editor of the journal and a superstar in the field of research methods in the Asia Pacific Career Development Association, Dr. Jose Domine. And I would like to call him a friend. I think we've hung out long enough now and seen each other in person, which feels more rare and rare during these times of the pandemic. And so I'd like to welcome Jose to the show with my typical opening question. How do you describe yourself professionally when people ask?
Well, first of all, Brian, I'm very pleased to be here. I'm happy to chat with you and connect in a way that we haven't had a chance to since the start of COVID. But that's a complex question because I wear many hats. So among the descriptions, so I'm actually licensed as a psychologist in the province where I work, and I teach now in a counseling psychology program. So psychologist might be one label, but before I moved here a couple of years ago, and for most of my professional career, I probably would have worn the label counselor educator, still think of myself in that way. My PhD though, and you had mentioned research methodology, my PhD is actually in measurement, evaluation, and research methodology. And so in some contexts, I'm known as the research methods person, but the lens that I bring to all of these things, all my other work, I've realized that it's at the core of what I do is a focus on helping people reach their next goal in life. So career development practitioner. Yes, I have all these other labels, but at my heart, if a student comes to me to talk about potentially applying to enter our program or thesis work or even methodological consultations, I always wear the lens of how will this help you to reach your goals? And to me, at the heart of that is career development practitioner.
Well, I would think then that you just gained a lot of fans out there in the Behind the Science podcast universe, because I get the pleasure to talk to authors and members of APCDA and career professionals from all over the world. And I think that that means that you're a lot like the rest of us. I think that we are value-driven in a specific sort of groove, but so many of us come to this field with these sort of companion experiences, companion skill sets, and companion education achievements that just sort of add to what it is that we're doing. And I really think that's what makes you the perfect guest for episode 3 of the podcast, because of the uniqueness of what you can bring. The role that I want to talk about today that's sort of a change up from the first two episodes is your role as an associate editor. So I'm not going to assume the audience out there knows what an associate editor of a scholarly journal is. Could you tell us a little bit about what that means and then maybe what it is that you do to prepare yourself for a role like that?
Sure thing. I'm happy to do that. I do think it varies from journal to journal, and I've been involved in various ways in a couple of journals. But for APCDA in particular, the role of associate editor, very simplistically, it's to help the editor. But what do I mean by that? I think reviewing submissions, reviewing other reviewers' comments about submissions. And when I say submissions, I mean manuscripts submitted for publication. But one of the things I love about reviewing for APCDJ in particular is the purpose of the review isn't just to point out all the problems or, you know, we have to maintain some kind of standard by rejecting a certain percentage. The approach to review here that I'm involved in as associate editor is providing strengths-focused feedback to authors, helping, working with authors to develop their ideas. You know, even if it means a couple rounds of review and you may not publish in the issue that you had hoped to, but let's work together to get this to the point where the important ideas that you have can be communicated well within the journal. So that style of review, yeah, really appreciate that about the journal.
Yeah. So if I can, like, I want to walk through, because again, I don't want to make any assumptions about who's listening. And I want, so one of the things that I heard you say was the word manuscript. So if we were to, so I think we have the term paper, the term manuscript, and the term article floating out there. Can you bring some order to that language universe for the uninitiated, if you will?
Absolutely. At its core, the three are labels for the same thing. Right. You know, so an author produces something, submits it for potential publication. It goes through several layers of review, initial reviewers, and then an associate editor to review that document. In my mind, I think of it as a manuscript before it gets published, and then an article after it gets published. But we are talking about the same document, just with different labels slapped on it.
Yeah, and for me, I actually make a point to call it an article for the first time when I send the final letter of acceptance. And so I always call it a manuscript in the correspondent through the revisions and the reviews to the author. But I want to signify the event of, even though it's not published yet, you can now say that this is an article, because it's been accepted for publication.
And just to clarify, even when we say manuscript, we're not talking a book size manuscript. It is still the length of an article, but yeah, it's that pre versus post publication status.
Yeah. And so there's some typical things about APCDJ that you would find in other journals. So the first one you referred to is what we call double blind peer review. So could you just quickly give the definition of what we mean when we say that interesting term?
Sure. And there's a couple of different parts to that. So when we say blind or anonymized, it means that the authors don't know who's doing the review, and the reviewers, so we remove all identifying information from the document, from the manuscript, when it goes out to review. The idea behind this process of blinding or anonymization is so that the study or the publication can be reviewed on its own merit without considering who the publisher is, so that, you know, you don't have somebody who would automatically reject an article that's written by a student, well, because it's only a student, for example.
Or not reject our article, Jose, because people don't like us as much.
Yes, well, there is always that, yes. The other part of that, yes, is the peer review. So APCDJ, like many journals in our field, relies on the review of other people working in the field. So whether that is scholars and researchers or practitioners who also have a scholarly bent, it is other people who are either knowledgeable about the field or in the field, and therefore can look at this from the lens of, is this important for career development practice?
Yep. And the board, which includes myself, the three associate editors, and the 16 board members as of this month, are published in each journal. So you know who the pool of people and experts are that are doing this process. You just don't know which of the two board members were assigned your article. And then you don't know which of the three associate editors are giving the second level technical review of the article. And in that review, you get access to both the manuscript, sorry, I called it an article by mistake, the manuscript, but you also get feedback from the two editorial board reviewers. So as an associate editor, A, you have a lot more expertise and experience oftentimes, but then you have more information to consider as well. What does that process look like? What is your mindset, or what are you thinking of when you get a manuscript for the first time, along with two reviews? Like, what's in your mind as you think about that, that the authors would want to know?
That's a great question, and it is quite different doing this review process from the associate editor role. I've been reviewing articles for years, but as an associate editor, I almost always I will read the article, but I will definitely read all the reviews before I more closely read the article. I find our reviewers are excellent. There's a diversity of perspectives, just because it's more than just my own perspective. And I often find it to be very useful, particularly because I live in Canada, and because a majority of our articles are published from authors working in Asia, the research is conducted in Asia, I find the reviewers are closer to the ground, so to speak. They're more able to understand the culture and the situation than I am. So I rely a lot on the reviews, and then I see my role as, and this is partly just me rather than associate editors in general, because of my background as a research methodologist, I do bring a methodological lens that I think not all associate editors or reviewers would. So I add that piece, but I start with the reviews, attend to them, and then sort of integrate them with any additional feedback that I have together. So it's like another layer of review where my job is made easier and I'm able to do a better job at associate editor review because of the hard work of the reviewers.
Yeah. And one of my roles as the host of the podcast is to always play language police. So I want to dig in a little bit. So when we talk about methodology, I want to talk about sort of, to my mind, like maybe four or five methodologies come to mind. So I would think like quantitative, qualitative, mixed methods. I think of historical work as a methodology. Mm-hmm. And then we have sort of practice evaluation, maybe.
Yeah.
And then maybe a conceptual piece. But like, could you just give the quick like difference between those different types of methodologies, recognizing that that was a really long list. So if you help, let me know.
So I do want to start out by saying that, as I understand it, ABCDJ is open to a wide articles published in a wide range of formats. So, and I think any of the readers can just go to our existing published issues of the journal and you'll be able to see the wide range of things. The core is not how, what kind of research method did we use. The core is how relevant is it to career development in the Asia Pacific region. But within that, you know, it doesn't always help to know, well, okay, I can use any format. So what does that actually mean I can do? So let me talk about some of the formats. So theoretical conceptual articles, you have an idea, is important to share with the readership of the journal. So this isn't a data-driven study where you're collecting and analyzing data. It's summarizing or presenting an idea, a theory, potentially an intervention where you describe the idea. So the format would be more of an essay-type format. And then you talked about qualitative, quantitative, mixed methods. Those are sort of variations of manuscripts that describe research where typically data has been collected or secondary analyzed, but there is some data set that undergoes some kind of analysis, some kind of consideration of the quality of the whole process, the data collection, the data analysis, and then writing up to reach some kind of conclusions. And that broad label covers a whole lot. So it can be anything from surveys or experiments that are conducted where you collect data that are quantitative, numerical, and then you use some kind of statistical analysis, usually some kind of statistics where you go beyond describing, but actually making inferences or drawing conclusions. It could be qualitative where the data might be interviews, it might be analyzing existing websites, bodies of text, but textual data, and words rather than numbers. And then if you were to have that data set and you wanted to do a quantitative analysis, you could recode it. But qualitative analysis typically would involve methods where you would actually review the textual data using the standards that are appropriate for the specific qualitative method and draw your conclusions that way. I could spend hours talking about the as many different statistical analyses that you can conduct. There are different kinds of qualitative analyses that you can conduct. We talked about mixed methods as well. That would be some kind of combination of numerical statistical analysis with textual and qualitative analysis. But then what makes mixed methods research mixed is some kind of integration of those findings. How do we look together at these numbers and what these people are actually saying? What does it mean? I mean, it's relatively easy if they're consistent. What does it mean if they're inconsistent? Struggling with those issues.
And so I just want to take a brief pause for the reader or the listener to catch their breath. So this is going to be audio only, but if you could see Jose's face right now, there's just bright light beaming off of his face with the excitement that he feels talking about research methods. And I'm sorry to interrupt. So to bring us back, I think the last two I'd like to prompt is sort of talking about these sort of evaluation studies or the field-based studies. And then one of us maybe can chime in with talking about historical as well, because that's something that's personally important to me for the journal.
I'll probably, let me cover the evaluation methods, and then I'll let you talk about historical methods. I'm probably less familiar with you than you for those. But in terms of evaluation methods, so these would be, I mean, methodologically, you might end up using quantitative and qualitative or a combination of both. But what distinguishes evaluation research that's published is here's an actual program that is being used in the field, and program or intervention or something that has an application to the field. And evaluation research is looking at how is that being applied in real life situations, as opposed to maybe in a university idealized research experimental setting, but looking at, and there are of course different types of evaluations which we would be open to publishing a wide variety. Some evaluations, it's primarily around building and improving the program. Other evaluations, the focus is on what kind of impact does this make? What kind of impact does this make in terms of change in the lives of the clients who are receiving this program? How does this program work relative to other programs? So often evaluation, there's one specific site. It's not like thousands of people including or contributing data. And there's often a variety of different kinds of data. So whereas a quantitative study, you might have lots of participants, but they're all filling out the same survey. Evaluation, you might look at what's from the perspective of the people receiving the service, from the perspective of the people providing the service, from the perspective of other key community stakeholders. And so there's often a variety of perspectives that are involved.
So if I were working, just to give an example of the word program, so if I were working in, say, a career center, let's say like a college career center, just to, since I see you're sitting at a university right now. And I wanted to identify a program that a college career center might write an article or manuscript about for to become an article. Like, does an example of what that program might be come to mind?
Let me think. And I mean, that is one of the core aspects of good evaluation in general, and particularly the kind of evaluations that would interest readers. I think not a broad kind of, let's just evaluate all our services. It's focused, here is one specific innovation. Let's say we're going to, in a post-COVID world, we're going to move all of our services, our one-on-one career advising online. And we want to have a look at what converting the one-on-one career advising online does beneficially or maybe not beneficially. Let's target that. Or we have this new career assessment tool and we're going to build three workshops to implement the tool. Yep. Let's take a look at whether these workshops, are they any good? How do they compare to the way we used to do things? What are the benefits that the people who attend the workshops can apply? So something more focused and specific for journal purposes, something that you think that other people would want to know about.
Yeah, and so then the data then could be things, just to rattle off a few. So there could be like satisfaction data, right? Where you ask the people what they thought of the workshop. Was it engaging? Did they think they learned something? Then a second type of data from that example might be user data. If they have to access the assessment after the workshops, what percentage of people accessed it and or completed that data? And then if that assessment is linked to something like major choice, you might be able to collect data from academic advising on whether or not students who participated in the workshop, completed the assessment, actually made a college decision or a major decision on time. Like, is that accurate ways to think about it?
Absolutely. And building on that, so one of the ways that makes evaluation research, program evaluation research, particularly useful for folks who are actually career development practitioners is if you're collecting quality assurance data. So the things that you're already collecting internally for quality assurance can potentially serve as the data set for you to write up to submit a manuscript. So it's not a whole lot of extra work to collect something, quote unquote, for research. It's you're already doing research. It's quality assurance research. It's evaluation for internal purposes. If the program that you're running is interesting, if your own internal evaluations are showing something that you think would be useful for other people to know, write up a manuscript. We would love to hear about it.
In my mind, when I see these types of evaluations, dissertation articles or manuscripts, I actually look at them in my mind as a gift, because you're a practitioner doing this work day in and day out. You care enough about the outcome of your effort to evaluate it. And what a gift it is to a career practitioner in another center in your country, in another center in the Asia Pacific region, in another center with a different language, but to be able to know with some level of confidence that implementing this program can have this impact. And that's so much more comforting than just making it up as we go along, which is quite anxiety provoking. So I see those types of articles as real gifts to the profession.
Absolutely. And Brian, you were going to talk a little bit about historical research.
Yeah, so I've actually written a few articles from a historical research perspective. For me, why I want to plant that seed for APCDJ is because we are pioneers, right? We are a broad, regionally focused with more than 25 countries as members of APCDA. We are common language focused. So we're not, you know, written in the language of any one or two of the of those 25 plus countries in APCDA. And so like the organization, we're doing something for the first time. That doesn't mean that career development hasn't been happening in our environment, in the scope of where we're doing this work for a long time. And I can name and I can see the faces of people who have built the foundation of career development in our region long before you and I showed up and started this journal 2 years ago. So I think that there is some utility, and again, with academic rigor, capturing that history and not acting like things just started when we published our first issue. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. Yes, absolutely. Particularly within the Asia Pacific, well, everywhere, but particularly given the change that's happening in the career development field in the Asia Pacific region right now, being aware of some of that history is particularly important. I did just think of another approach to writing articles that I'd like to mention, and this would be the various kinds of systematic ways of reviewing the existing literature. And so there's a variety of different literature review formats. You might hear labels of meta-analysis, meta-synthesis, scoping review, systematic review, and all of those capture different specific ways of conducting reviews. But one of the things that the different specific methods of review have in common is they start with a desire to find out what the overall sentiment in the existing literature says about a particular problem or a particular issue. Is overall, what does the literature that has looked at cognitive behavioral career development approaches, what does it say about the effectiveness of those approaches? Yeah. Or even as simple as, is there any research conducted in Asia on this particular intervention or this particular theory? So starting out with a question, follow the existing guidelines for conducting specific kinds of review, probably don't have time to go into all of those now, and then write up the results of your review of the existing literature, which will in itself contribute something new to the literature.
I think you're having a humble moment, Dr. Domine, because I believe that you were second author on a lead article that was highlighted in our first podcast that used one of those techniques. Can you just give us the 30-second commercial for that article?
Absolutely. So first, let me say that the work was primarily the first author, who is now a doctoral student, but she was a master's student at the time that she conducted this review, and she took the lead. Her passion is in the area of transgender people's experiences. And when we talked about, well, what's a project that fits with your interests and mine that can be done within the short time frame, she decided to conduct a review of existing literature on career development in transgender folks with particular application to the Asia Pacific region. To my knowledge, nobody else has done that kind of a review from the perspective of Asian and Pacific perspectives on the issue.
Yeah, very good, very good.
Mm-hmm. Now, she's fantastic. All my students are fantastic, actually.
Of course. I just want to point out, to my knowledge, I think a common misconception is that to get published in a scholarly journal, that you have to be either a doctor, an academic, or with a PhD, or a doctoral student. So I appreciate you identifying Danielle as a master's student. I think of the lead article 2 issues ago on career development in Singapore, which was our second episode, of this podcast. And I believe that there were master students, doctoral students, working career advisors and career coaches in authorship there. Which brings me to the last, I have a couple of questions to wrap up, but I do want to put in a quick plug. Jose nodded to this, but we really do take a mentoring approach to this academic process. It will not be easy to write a publishable article for this scholarly journal. And we joked about that on episode 2 of this podcast. I think I went through 8 or 9 revisions with the authors before they submitted it for blind peer review.
Oh, wow.
Those in academia are going to probably make a funny face right now. One of the things that we've implemented to make this a more caring and strength-based approach is that I will work with authors to get their paper ready for review. And then in the first round of review, I actually take myself out of the review process. So if I've worked with an author ahead of time, I almost said a priori because we're talking about research, but if I worked with them ahead of time, that review goes to 2 editorial board members, their review goes to an associate editor, and I always follow the associate editor's recommendation for that article. Now, if it goes through a second round of revision, since I'm no longer a part of that process, then I may weigh in after that initial review. So this is sort of on the lines of sort of the ethics of in the way that these boards work, but we really wanted to implement a way to encourage everyone that does career development. You don't have to submit a manuscript for the journal, but we want you to feel like that you can if you choose to. And so I really want to make that impression. One of the questions I really want to ask, and we're going to wrap up here in maybe 5 minutes or so, Jose, but can you tell the story of the first article that you ever got published?
I absolutely can. So it was published in 2006, so it would have been about 2004 when I was working on it. And it's actually informed the way that I work with my own students. So I was a student myself and working with a faculty mentor who, it was an independent research project, using her data set, and you know, what can we do? Let's do something that's actually meaningful for publication rather than write another paper that to be graded. And so I did a quantitative analysis of an existing data set on educational and career-related help seeking in high school. And the data set was an existing one, it wasn't designed to answer my research question. So part of the process was, let's figure out a research question that can actually be answered, given that we don't have time in this course for me to collect data. So that was the first hurdle. Once we did that, we did the analyses, first set of analyses, this quantitative analysis. Okay, nothing significant came out, and the effect sizes were tiny. We could end it at that point, because I could write it up for the course purposes, and it would be fine, but not publishable. Let's go back, ask a slightly different research question, and see if there is something within there that's meaningful. And so we did that the second time around, did find something that was meaningful, publishable, and submitted it for publication in the Canadian Journal of Counseling, now Canadian Journal of Counseling and Psychotherapy, which I actually happen to be editor of 15 years later. But what I really learned about from that process was, and I really appreciated, was the mentoring that I received from my professor, encouraging me as a student, yes, you could do this for course purposes, but I think there's potential there. You should see it, do some more analysis, see if it's publishable. And then providing me with guidance around, you know, okay, so there is something meaningful there, but let's talk about how to get this written up in a way that is actually publishable. Writing for publication, writing an article, is quite different than writing course or term paper. And so the mentoring that I received there really helped. One of the things I love about APCDJ is that not everybody has a professor like that. And one of the things that you do, Brian, is you provide a similar kind of mentoring. And I've taken that in my own future work as a professor now. I will encourage my students. So Danielle, I think in an earlier issue of the journal, one of my other students who was now a doctoral student, master student at the time, was first author on another publication. And I...
Q1, yeah.
Yeah.
That was our first issue.
Yes, yeah. I learned more than getting the publication out there, which is fine, but 15 years later, maybe a bit dated. I learned how to be a professor who mentors my students for publication.
And I'm going to need to ask, do you remember the title of your article?
Yes, yes. So it was Domene, Shapka, and Keating. I don't remember it. I have it in front of me. And the title is Educational and Career-Related Help Seeking in High School, an Exploration of Students' Choices.
Love it. And I would just like to say, for the record, because ethics are an extremely important part of this process, it is possible for associate editors and board members to publish in the journal. It's my job to make sure that they are recused in all ways from any of the review process. So Jose had no idea what was going on in the review process for his two articles, and honestly wasn't even informed except by the first author, who was the corresponding author, that he got accepted. Yeah. So he wouldn't even hear that from me as the editor.
As the editor. That returns us to the blind review process, the anonymization. Not only does it prevent articles from being excluded because it's not the right kind of person publishing, but it means that nobody gets an unfair advantage for getting published because of who they happen to be.
So important, yeah. So the last thing I'd like to ask, just for a short response. So we have some people out there hopefully listening to this podcast, makes them think, well, maybe I could publish an APCDJ. What are your hopes for the journal and the authors into the future?
If you're thinking maybe I could, I do definitely encourage you to consider APCDJ as a publication venue, particularly, for anybody, but particularly if you may be more of a practitioner who hasn't had a lot of experience publishing. In my experience, you will get more mentoring, more assistance to make your important ideas publishable in a way so that the final product, the published article, is high quality work. We do absolutely require that when something reaches publication, it's high quality, but we do a lot more to help you get to that final state than some other journals might. Not all other journals, some journals are great, but other journals may not invest in. And for me, as I think about my broader vision for the journal, for career development in the Asia Pacific region, I do think the professionalization, the growing a body of research from scholars who are in the Asia Pacific about the Asia Pacific experience, career interventions, career strategies in particular, that are developed in the Asia Pacific or the Asia Pacific, rather than relying on bringing things from other continents over and just assuming that they can be used. And don't get me wrong, there's room for that. There are ways to adapt things created in one culture for use in another culture. But I would love to see more research, particularly applied career development practice research, on intervention strategies, on experiences within the Asia Pacific region. That, I think, will be like building that evidence base will advance the field as a whole. And I think our journal is well positioned to help move that vision forward.
And if we can accomplish that together with the rest of the team, I mean, that's the type of lasting legacy project that helps form a profession, form an approach to good work, and then distribute that good work broadly, which is really what I know all of us hope for the region. Well, I was just sitting here thinking, David Bluestein in The Psychology of Working quotes Isaac Prilatensky in this idea of what is a good life. And I think professionally, a good life is if you can look at someone and know that you've collaborated on good work, that you share a friendship with good laughs, and that you can learn from as both a colleague and a mentor. And I look at Jose and I feel that way about you. And I am just so grateful for the work that you've given to this journal. And earlier today, signed up for a second 3-year term as associate editor. So great work. And thank you so much for this, Jose.
Well, and thank you. I think your leadership is one of the reasons why the journal is where it is today.
And we're still building something, but I can't wait to get there together. So
absolutely.
So this is in the can then. This is episode 3 of Behind the Science of Career Development. I'm lining up episode 4. The goal here is just to produce an episode every 4 to 6 weeks and to keep a consistent stream into your life about the science behind what we are all so passionate to do for a living. Please follow, subscribe, download, rate, give feedback so that we can use this platform to continue to do the good work that we're trying to do as a profession and through the journal. Until next time, Ryan Hutchison, your host, signing off. Thank you, Jose.
Bye.